You are listening to Security Squad, a CertSecurity.com podcast for October 23rd, 2008. Vendor transparency, cybersecurity for the next president, the latest on the IT security job market, and security's bad reputation.
If pressure needs to be put upon vendors, let's think about who needs to put that pressure on them. Is it really security pros?
Anybody who looks at the situation objectively cannot be happy with what's going on, you know, in terms of cybersecurity nationally for the last 8 years.
It's incumbent upon security professionals to really learn how to do more with less. I mean, it's almost a cliche, but it's really true now.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Security Squad. We've had a little break since our last edition back in July, and we do have some interesting topics to discuss. We're going to be asking, are vendors being transparent enough? We're going to be talking about politics. What kind of cybersecurity issues will the next president face? We'll also review Bush's record on cybersecurity briefly. And we'll look at the economy. Is there a rough road ahead for security pros? And then finally, we're going to talk about security's bad reputation. What can security pros do to keep data locked down and keep employees happy? Or the other question is that really their role? But first, let's introduce the panel. Mike Momoso joins us. He is editor of Information Security Magazine. Mike, what's on tap in the next edition?
The next edition is going to be our December issue, which is a combined issue with January, and we're going to be talking about the importance of integrating security into the overall business and the effectiveness of using essentially security steering committees to pull this off.
And we'll be talking about that in a little bit, actually.
Yep.
So that should be interesting. Also in the studio for an appearance is Eric Parizeau. You haven't been on the panel last couple of times, so it's good to have you back. Eric is the CertSecurity.com site editor, and you've been working on a relaunch of an old security school. Tell us about that.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be back. I was on a minor league rehab stint for a few weeks there, but it's great to be back up here in the majors. We just relaunched our CISSP Essential Security School. This is a 10-lesson school focusing on free training for those security pros who are interested in getting their CISSP certification. The big draw is nearly 10 hours of free video instruction featuring Sean Harris of Logical Security. So I encourage all of our listeners to check that out, and you can check that out as well as all of our other security schools at searchsecurity.com/security school.
Excellent. And finally, Dennis Fisher is on hand. Dennis is executive editor of Information Security Magazine and CertSecurity.com. And Dennis always has his ear to the ground for that next emerging threat. How you doing, Dennis?
Very well.
So we're going to go right into it. The first question we've got is, are vendors being transparent enough? Now, that question came from a keynote given by Mozilla's Windows Snyder at the recent IT Security World. Windows says software developers won't make security a priority unless users get them to change. She says security pros need to press their vendors to be more forthcoming about vulnerabilities and security information. Dennis, there's always this fine balance. Are we getting enough information from vendors?
For the most part, no. I don't think that we are. The number of vendors who give out any information whatsoever about vulnerabilities, even after they're fixed, is pretty low. You can count the major ones, Microsoft, Oracle, Adobe, some others. But for the most part, we get very little information. Every once in a while, you'll see VMware will come out with some monster patch that fixes like 40 vulnerabilities that have been building up for 6 or 8 months or something like that. But I agree 100% with what Windows said. I think a lot of the onus should fall on the users to put some pressure on their vendors, because that's the best way they can do it. If the users start telling their vendors, listen, unless we're getting enough information or more information from you about the security of your products, we're going to move along. You know, there's other people out there that can provide the same software that you have. Give us some more information. We need to know about the security of these things.
But didn't that backfire on Microsoft? Microsoft put all this effort into security, and now they're basically, the Vista users are not very happy.
I don't think it backfired. I think that some of the security features that they put into Vista were just not the right ones. They just didn't work as well as people thought they were, or should. They were a little annoying, like the user access control feature that, you know, annoyed everybody that used it. But I think that's a different thing than the security of the software itself.
Right.
You know, the outward security features are different than, you know, the relative security of the software and, you know, how many flaws it has and whether it's reliable.
Mike, what's your take on this? As Dennis said, Snyder criticized vendors that package security vulnerabilities into major service packs. Well, basically, Windows says that puts end users in more risk.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think that you get enough vulnerability information from the vendors. But at the same time, I'm not sure that I buy it entirely that users have that much power to make a difference. Very few companies are big enough and spend enough money with these vendors to convince them to alter their ways. Unless you're a huge enterprise of the U.S. government that's buying millions and millions of dollars worth of whatever product it is, I don't think you have enough muscle and buying power to influence them that way.
Reference what Mike said, that you know there are very, very few organizations that have that kind of buying power to really put the pressure on the vendor, but that's essentially what happened to Microsoft. That's what caused them to start Trustworthy Computing. And I think it was, you know, it was the government, it was some pretty large enterprises, some automotive companies, some others that got to them. But it was also, I think, sort of an accumulation of moaning and complaining from the regular enterprise customers that they had over the years that just said, listen, it's just not good enough anymore. You know, you need to fix this stuff.
Well, why shouldn't the government get involved maybe and hold vendors more accountable to building software that doesn't have as many security holes in it? Eric, what's your take on that?
Well, Rob, you know I'm a strong opponent of letting the government fix all your problems. But to make a couple points, first off, I feel like if pressure needs to be put upon vendors, let's think about who needs to put that pressure on them. Is it really security pros? In reality, I don't think so. It's the business units within organizations that are making these software purchases. Now, you know, if you're a security pro and your organization uses, you know, software product X, you can call up, you know, vendor X and say, rattle your saber and say your software isn't secure, but they're going to hang up the phone and laugh at you because ultimately what you have to say doesn't matter. The security pros need to work on influencing the business teams within their organization, and that means finding a seat at the table when it's time to select these products in the first place. The other thing I would say, and maybe it's to call out Wendell Snyder's comments a little bit, because I do feel like they're a little bit unfair toward the software vendors. I feel like she's calling out all the Cadillac Escalade drivers from the behind the wheel of a Prius, if you know what I mean. Granted, she's been at Microsoft, so she understands the problems out there. But at the same time, I think it's disingenuous of Mozilla to call out software vendors when their business models call for a totally different set of priorities.
What do you mean by that? Now, let's talk a little bit about that. I know Window talked a little bit about how Mozilla is being extremely transparent. One area that they're building out is the set of security metrics. You know, and these security metrics are going to include vulnerability severity, the find rate, the fix rate. So they're being pretty transparent.
Well, it's easy to talk about transparency when you don't necessarily have intellectual property to protect like a lot of the other commercial software vendors do. I mean, if Microsoft, you know, could open up its source code tomorrow and not be raked over the coals from a business perspective as a result, I'm sure it would. But that's just not the reality that most commercial software vendors have to deal with today. So I feel like it means addressing the situation in a different way from the perspective of vendors. And that goes back to the point I made at first, which is, again, organizations have to influence vendors during the purchase process. I mean, once that money's been spent, there's just not a lot of influence that's going to be had on them. So it involves going back to the table, or if you're an information security pro, finding a way to get a seat at the table, and then once you do, influencing your colleagues by explaining the value of security and software and what it means to go about purchasing insecure software and the ramifications of doing that.
Well, Dennis, what's your take? Does Eric have a valid argument here? And, you know, I mean, obviously the Firefox browser is open source. It's the source code is widely available.
Yeah, I mean, it is two different models that they have, right? I mean, Microsoft has for years shared limited amounts of their source code with some of their partners and other ISVs. But I think that's a separate issue. They've done a very good job with transparency, I think, as much as possible for any commercial software vendor. You know, they talk a lot about the way that their threat modeling process works. They talk a lot about the way that their whole software security process works. Window knows all of that because she helped develop that threat modeling process, and they're doing that same thing at Mozilla now with Firefox and their other products. Mozilla is fairly transparent with their stuff. I mean, they post a lot of information about vulnerabilities and about ongoing projects and that kind of stuff, but even with their visibility within the tech community, they're still not Microsoft. You know, what they do still doesn't have the huge effect as of what Microsoft does or Oracle does or anybody else does. So I think it's, you know, we may have to just separate those two, as Eric said. I mean, I think that's a very valid point.
And with that, I think we'll move on to the next issue. Up next, let's talk about politics, of course. Anti-cybercrime legislation was recently sent to the president, and those legal provisions tackle botnets. It prompts us to ask, you know, what's next for the next president? What should the next president do to improve cybersecurity? Mike, what's your take?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be very high on the agenda for the next president. This little thing of the economy and the recession might take precedence for a while. I think it would definitely help to have somebody the other question asked who's going to be the next president? I mean, if it's, you know, there might be different agendas depending on who gets in, and also whether there's a czar or a director or somebody at the White House as opposed to Homeland Security and where that office lives and how much influence and how much the ear of the cabinet or the president they'll have.
Dennis, what's your take? The government is so notorious on moving slowly on cybersecurity issues. We know that internally government agencies are being held accountable, or at least they're starting to be held accountable a lot more. Are the feds doing a better job right now?
I think internally they are, but externally in terms of, you know, helping private industry secure the critical infrastructure and information sharing with the private sector, you know, moving slowly would be an improvement over what's going on right now. I mean, it's been 8 years since, you know, this is completely separate from party politics or anything, but anybody who looks at the situation objectively cannot be happy with what's going on, you know, in terms of cybersecurity nationally for the last 8 years. You know, there's been a revolving door at DHS in terms of the person whose overall responsibility or overall responsible for cybersecurity. We've had a lot of good guys in there, but every one of them, Howard Schmidt, Amit Yoran, all of them have looked at the situation, found out that they don't really have any power, have no power to change anything in the private sector. Nobody inside the Beltway really wants to listen to them because the responsibility was taken out of the White House a few years ago and moved to DHS. So I think what needs to happen is, as a few people have recommended, is to move it back into the White House, whether it's part of the National Security Council or just some sort of position inside the White House the way it was before, when Richard Clark was there and Howard Schmidt and Andy Purdy and all of those guys, and just give it some more, give it a little more juice, because it's got none right now.
I'm going to go into politics a little bit. I know Obama has advocated for the creation of a national advisor who would report directly to him rather than DHS. Right. He's talked a little bit about that in some of his speeches earlier this year. McCain hasn't really talked about an advisor like Obama has, you know, in the White House. But he has gone out of his way in speeches to support funding increases for research and development of high-tech security systems. And he also makes a point of promoting the sharing of resources between federal research agencies. So, you know, that's something that Bruce Schneier has talked about a lot, about security research between federal agencies. Eric, what's your take on this?
Well, I think if we could get Al Gore to take the top government security job, that would be great, since he invented the internet and naturally.
He does have the Nobel Prize.
He invented it, so I'm sure he knows how to secure it, right? That's what I do. But no, as Dennis has covered extensively, I mean, he knows more about this than anyone. You know, at best, national cybersecurity has been ignored for the last 8 years. And at worst, it's been severely botched with the revolving door of leadership that's gone in and out for the very reason that they don't have, you know, any real power, as Dennis alluded to. In terms of which candidate's going to understand the issue, I mean, you know, politics aside, I'm not convinced John McCain understands what the internet is, never mind knows how to secure it. And Senator Obama, I'm sure, will probably, you know, call 1,000 people to get recommendations before he decides to do anything. So I'm not convinced I see either choice necessarily improving the situation in the short term.
I wonder if there's some pushback because, you know, sometimes people ask how much should we let the federal government crack down on things like cybersecurity before it infringes on our privacy rights and infringes on a free and open internet. What's your take on that?
Privacy, I think, is a separate thing. You know, if you're talking about like the warrantless wiretapping and all of that kind of stuff, that's a separate issue. And they've completely gone off the reservation on that, too. But I think one thing that needs to be said here is that, for you know, the Bush administration has used this specter of terrorism to its advantage for a long time now. And that goes, you know, double for cybersecurity. They've focus so much attention on the potential of cyber terrorism that they completely missed the cyber crime problem that has mushroomed in the last 4 or 5 years. So these huge international gangs, these, you know, it's an enormous problem that they completely missed and are just now trying to catch up on. And, you know, legislation making operating a botnet a felony is a joke because most of these guys don't live in the U.S., and even the ones that do, you're not going to find them. You know, they're going to have 4 or 5 arrests every year. That doesn't make any difference.
All right, so let's move on. We're going to talk about the uncertain economy. The financial industry, obviously, is a mess. We're seeing a lot of mergers and acquisitions, and banks are going out of business. What's this mean for security pros? Are their jobs safe, Eric?
Rob, I think it's sort of a mixed bag. Overall, according to some research I've done, it looks like salaries for – this is according to our good friend David Foote of Foote Partners. Mm-hmm. According to his data, of the roughly 160-some-odd certifications he tracks, salaries have declined for those certifications overall for 8 consecutive quarters now. So I think it suggests that IT managers are probably favoring those with less experience, since those with more experience tend to be the ones that have the certifications. But I will borrow an excellent point from the Dice.com career blog, saying that as governments institute more regulations and laws pertaining to cybersecurity, there's going to be a greater need for security professionals to implement those laws and ensure that organizations are up to par. For instance, the Wall Street Journal reported that that Massachusetts, our home state here, which has an encryption law going into effect in January, has received reports of nearly 320 data breaches over the last 11 months, and about 75% of those involve non-encrypted data. So I know at least here, as that law goes into effect, I'm sure there's going to be a pretty big interest in getting security pros to make sure organizations are in compliance.
Mike, what's your take on this? I know you talk to a lot of upper-level people, and especially CISOs. Is there going to be some cutbacks in terms of the technology industry? Is this going to be on the level of the cuts that we've seen in the dot-com bust?
I don't know that they'll be that drastic. We've got a couple of surveys going out to our subscribers about this very topic, about how they're going to handle the recession and what they're going to have to do in the economy. My guess is that optimistically, at best, budgets are going to stay flat for security budgets, I mean. I would guess they're going to go down. Whether that impacts job security overall, I don't know. I think it's incumbent upon security professionals to really learn how to do more with less. I mean, it's almost a cliche, but it's really true now. You know, in terms of assessing risk and applying resources the best they know how in those particular areas. It's going to be a really challenging year for a lot of companies across the board. And if security is viewed
as a cost center. I mean, look out.
I think that that really takes us to our final topic, which is some of the recent reports and surveys out there. It talks about what seems like a security's bad reputation. There was a study done by IDC on behalf of RSA that talked about the majority of senior managers believe IT security risk is the largest single obstacle to innovation in their business right now. And there was another survey out there that found that end users are doing their best to get around some rigid security policies because they just need to get their work done. Some of them are actually bringing sensitive information home, and they've even admitted to it in these surveys to get their work done. What can security pros do to keep data locked down and keep employees happy and at the same time? And is that really their role?
Yeah, it's a tough situation. The IDC RSA survey was an interesting one to me. I talked to Art Coviello about that. He's the president of RSA. To me, the interesting thing was that so many people found security to be, you know, not just kind of a pain, but a serious barrier to actually getting things done. How they define innovation, is up in the air. That word doesn't have a lot of meaning to me.
Marketing word, yeah.
Right, yeah. I don't know what that means, honestly. But to me, it sounds like, you know, I've got this project that I want to get done and security is in my way, so I'm going to go around the wall somehow or dig a hole through it. That's a dangerous attitude. You know, if security's not getting any respect inside the organization, there's probably something else wrong. And, you know, I'm not sure how you address that, but it's a bad situation if your employees feel like security is in their way and it's not helping them do their jobs. It's preventing them from doing their jobs. That's essentially the opposite of what you want them to feel. You want them to feel that it's enabling them to do their jobs better, more efficiently.
But how? You know, how can security possibly help employees do their job better? It doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, one, you know, sort of low level example is we all work remotely a lot. If we didn't have a secure VPN, we couldn't do that.
Right.
Okay. So that's an easy example. But, you know, in terms of these large projects, I'm not sure exactly. It differs from organization to organization. But at the very least, you want people to feel like security is, you know, a net neutral. You don't want it to be a negative, on a lot of levels, which is how these people obviously feel.
I wonder if it's really the technology, though, that is causing all this. The technology is not unique enough to a particular business circumstance, and it can't adapt very easily. It can't be tweaked very easily by security pros to allow some people the ability to get their job done easier and make sure that other people are locked out of some sensitive information.
You know, I'm kind of with Eric on this. I mean, if you're especially a publicly traded company and you haven't found a way to integrate security into business processes yet, then you know what? Bring on the hackers. You deserve it. If for no other reason, you've got regulations to comply to that don't give you an out. PCI, SOX, California Data Breach Notification Act, any of the state data breach notification laws, you have no choice but to comply. Or you can't do business. You can't, if you violate PCI, you can't do credit card transactions. So companies have to find a way to integrate security. It's not an add-on anymore. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. You have to have security talking to different business units on the ground floor projects. They have to at least introduce the idea that, there's a risk here. If you do it this way, maybe you should do it that way. There's different ways that security can approach the problem and enable, rather than just be that barrier and say, no, can't do it.
Yeah, I agree with this sentiment that, you know, security is not in the warm, fuzzy business. They should not be, you know, concerning themselves with how, you know, Joe in accounting feels about his password reset function.
Or Joe the plumber.
Or Joe the plumber, correct. Especially Joe the plumber. I think the problem comes in when the security organization is just, they don't give you a reason for what they're doing. They're too rigid. And so the employees say, you know what? Well, forget you. I'm going to figure this out on my own. Maybe an insecure way to do it, but I need this partner to have access to this so we can get this project done. If you're not going to set that up for me, then I'm going to put it on a thumb drive, unencrypt it. I'm going to walk it over to him and give it to him. You know, that's a problem. But there's got to be some kind of happy medium. And it appears that most of these organizations aren't finding it at this point.
It probably goes right down to the most basic part of any security program, and that is the data itself. It doesn't seem to me that companies have yet gotten a handle on where their data resides, what data is most important and needs to be secured more than other kinds of data. So what do they do? They put blanket controls on the entire company, and so you've got people that need access to certain kinds of data, and they don't have that access at the right time. It's just this big revolving circle.
Right. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's a problem, and, you know, surveys are nice. They're not going to fix the problem, but...
We've been hearing about this for so long. I mean, yeah. I feel like, you know, when I was reporting for searchoracle.com, searchdatabase.com, which we don't even have anymore, it was all about the data and all about metadata and all about companies trying to get control of their master data through master data management. And it's just, it hasn't, they haven't yet gotten a grip on their data.
No, I agree. I think what they need is some kind of really cool acronym to tie it all together, and then we'll be fine.
MDM, baby. Ooh. Master Data Management.
It doesn't work. It sounds like ecstasy. Isn't that what MDMA or something?
All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. Well, that does it for this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For now, I'm Rob Westerveld, and for Dennis Fisher, Eric Perrazone, and Mike Mimoso, have a great day.